This podcast of Bookworm is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. Or you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm happy to have as my guest Annie Proulx, whose collection of stories, Coast Range, I would think many of you know. They're Wyoming stories. She did a second volume of Wyoming stories called Bad Dirt, and that's her most recent book. We're here on as a kind of first for Bookworm because one of the stories in Coast Range, Brokeback Mountain, has been adapted and made into a film by Ang Lee. The screenwriters were Larry McMurtry and Diane, is it Osana?
Diana Osana.
Yes, and, you know, it's one of those kind of, I think, heavenly events for a writer when a movie actually stays true and fairly close to the range of the work. As someone who's had this experience with several of your books, what has this one been like?
Well, that's actually a more complicated question you might think. When I wrote that story, I had a serious problem with the characters. In all of my writing, I've had no problems at all with characters. They do what they're told. They tell the story. When they're no longer useful, I get rid of them, and away they go. But in this story, I had to stretch my imagination to a depth I never had before. A middle-aged woman writing about two 19-year-old guys who are very confused about their sexuality and eventually move into a love affair is not the ordinary kind of thing that I think about. So I had a lot of very serious imagining to do. And it took months and months to write this story. If all I did was write at this pace, I'd probably have a lifetime output of maybe 7 short stories. But what happened is that at the end, when the story was finally finished, and the imagining could stop, it didn't. And the characters were there, and I had to write that old ace in the hole about the panhandle of Texas to try to get rid of these guys because they were intrusive, and they wouldn't go. And after 8 years, I pretty much had gotten rid of Jack and Ennis until in September when I saw the film in New York for the first time, having seen not a drop of it, not a scene, having heard nothing, did not visit the set. Had no idea what I was going to see. And I sat in that theater, and those characters roared up off the page and back into the screen and into my brain again, and they were there with the volume turned very, very high. And once again, I had to try and find an exorcist.
I think that's true for readers as well, because, you know, I read that story when it first appeared in The New Yorker, what is it, around
Eight years ago.
And, you know, I knew your work some, but I'm kind of reading, and it's fairly unusual for any of the stories in The New Yorker to occur outdoors. That's a first surprise. And, you know, they're cowboys, and I'm kind of sitting there saying...
No, they're not. No, don't say that. I'm
ranchers?
Fighting that. No, they're ranch hands. They're just ranch kids, really. They aren't anything. They would like to be cowboys because they live in the West, but really they're not. They try in different ways.
One tries working in rodeo.
Yeah.
The other is working around stock. Mm-hmm. I guess a city person like me calls that cowboys.
Right. Well, anybody who sees the hat and the boots says cowboy, but they're not real cowboys.
And I'm saying to myself, I think these boys are falling in love with one another. And I'm thinking, no, though this must just be some rigging in my brain. Maybe I want them to be. And then, sure enough, they are. And I don't actually check the cover to see if it's The New Yorker, but I'm thinking, this is The New Yorker. And before long, they're having sex. And I thought, My goodness, this story is causing shockwaves in me, certainly. Mm-hmm. And then when it came out in its book form, there's a couple of paragraphs that aren't in the New Yorker story, if mm-hmm. I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of sitting there because I had a hunger for them, too. There are characters that seem so complexly imagined that they overtake a short story or their duration in a book. It's like all those people who wrote versions of Don Quixote between book one and book two, so that by the time book two got published by Cervantes, Quixote could read about himself.
That happened with the writer too. It got to be too much, and maybe that would happen with every story. You know, if I took 6 months on a story, which is can write a novel in 3 months. 6 months on a short story, not very cost effective, but it was a good thing to do. And once I got started on it, I was really compelled by something. As I say, a strange hand came from above and was guiding the pen part of the time. There was something in the story that was larger than I had thought it would be in the beginning, and I don't know what it is. There's a universality there that, and I don't know where it came from. It just came. It just happened. So,
well, for me, it's the longing for love.
Oh, yeah.
That the story captures, that there's this huge sense that these men, you know, whatever lies they tell and refusals that they make, this love seems hardwired into them and is unmitigatable, unavoidable, unignorable.
And inexpressible.
And inexpressible, yeah.
The other thing that I wanted to mess with in this story, too, was to get some idea of the complex plurality of human sexuality, the unclear lines, the drifts from one pasture to another, the back and forth and interplay, instead of this very rigid construct of him, her, he, she. It was interesting to me to put a lot of gray into the story, and again count on readers to pull from their own lives and experience and thoughts what they knew about life and sex that contradicted the clear-cut pattern that's given to us, you know, the coloring book of life that we get when we're little kids.
Now, when it was announced that among the screenwriters would be Larry McMurtry, I thought, well, isn't that amazing, you know? And Diana as well, they've worked in the realm of Western history. You were trained as a historian, but McMurtry has been doing historical essays
and
has a real interest in getting things right, in not being inaccurate. When you finally saw the story transformed into film in New York, what were the surprises that were there for you?
Well, you know how it came to be turned into a screenplay. Diana had a friend who handed her the copy of the New Yorker and said, "This is a story you have to read." And she has insomnia. In the middle of the night, she started to read it and became quite gripped by it. Reread it the next morning and continued to be gripped by it. Went to Larry and said, "You've got to read this story." And Larry said, "Do you know me? I never read short fiction." And she said, "We'll read this one." And he read it, and they both thought it could be made into a film. Got in touch with me, and I knew Larry because I hang out at his bookstore down in Archer City. And when I was working on various things, I would be down there ferreting out wonderful books on Texas history. If it had been anybody else in the world, I would have not signed a contract, but with Larry's ear and eye and deep knowledge and the fact that he's got the wonderful bookstore, I trusted him. I trusted them both to make this work. They optioned the story out of their own pockets, which is pretty unusual. And I signed the contract, and 3 months or so later, I saw their first draft of the screenplay. And there were some changes that I made, mostly in a little bit of language, and it was a difference between what would be said in Wyoming and what would be said in Texas kind of thing. But when I saw that film in September, oh boy, what were the things that were different? I really, you know, it's hard to answer that question, very hard.
All sorts of friends have been asking me as the so-called, you know, literary expert, and I'd say that the difference between the story and the film is that when I read the story, I found myself in tears. And when I saw the film, I felt that the film had made me cry, that there was a kind of movie sadness sauce that somehow got ladled over the material, whereas the story is written in somewhat of the stoic way of these men. It's not insisting that you feel anything in particular.
Right.
And as a result, my emotions just leaked out through me unawares. Mm-hmm. It came as a real startlement to me.
Right. I'm very happy to hear that because it means the thing works the way I had hoped it would work, that for the reader what's inside is necessary to complete the story and fill it out and put the meaning in it. The place was very important to me, too, while I was writing it. Place is always important to me in everything I write, and you know I write about rural situations. But Brokeback Mountain itself, the idea of using the mountain as what they call in science fiction a wormhole, where two characters go in and they come out differently. And this was a thing I wanted to play with from the beginning, and I think it worked.
Well, one of the pleasures of the story as well as of the movie is that as you read, you sense that this isn't some generalized brand name Western accent, that, you know, what's being heard here is particular to the place. And it's Wyoming. It's not Texas. It's not... And even in the story, it's noted that Jack's accent changes, that he says cow differently in Texas than he said in Wyoming, and wife becomes waff.
Mm-hmm.
and one senses that the movie, too, worked carefully to make sure with dialogue coaches on the set that the tone would be the tone of Wyoming. What does it mean to you to be accurate, to capture the particularities?
Everything. It means everything to me. And it should mean everything to every writer. I feel very, very strongly about this. And when I do make an error, and as always, there's always the sharp-eyed reader who tells you about it, I lie awake with shame. I hurt. I really, truly do if I get something wrong. So I take pains.
Oh, because, well, they're felt. Because, you know, there is that thing that happens. As reading becomes as much of a passing way of life as the Western way of life, one senses as one reads some writers now that you're reading the generic version rather than the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference, well, the difference is so great that you almost say, well, if this is what writing is going to become, I can accept that reading will die, because if it's not enshrining the deep insight and ear and eye of a writer, what is it?
Mm-hmm. I agree with you entirely. It's the thing about the film, the story, writing, architecture. It used to be that writing and architecture were the great permanent monuments that made up culture, that made up civilization. And I think now to that we absolutely must add film. We have to, because that's the language of our time, not the book, not the written word. And for a writer who takes pains and who cares, it is painful to have to admit that film is bigger this story, when it was published, I had a lot of letters from men, gay and straight, who said, this is my story. This is why I left Wyoming. Now I know what hell my son went through. I'm not gay, but I cried. I work construction, but I love this story. You know, this kind of thing were the letters I'm getting, but I was getting. But the thing is that I have to say that the film does that for many people that would never have read the story and who don't like reading and wouldn't read. So some kind of a dialogue is starting in the wake of this story, which I find extremely interesting and valuable.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Annie Prue about her story, Brokeback Mountain, from her collection, Close Range, which was published by Scribner. It was a movie by Ang Lee, has just been released based on the prize-winning story. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Annie Prue about her story, Brokeback Mountain. Now, just as you say, these boys are not anything. They're not cowboys. They may have wanted to be because they live in the West. Mm. Is that also because the option of becoming a cowboy is unavailable to them? Are there still cowboys?
I think there are. I don't think there are a whole lot of them. And in fact, one of the interesting things that's come out of this is the Wyoming Council of Arts wants to get something going in 2006 to discuss this film and the story and others that other Wyoming writers have done, and to talk about what is a cowboy, you know, today, what is one? There was a 15-year period in the late 19th century when there were cowboys associated with the trail drives up from Texas to Montana. That was it, 15 years, bye-bye cowboys. But we still have them with us, and they're infinitely larger than they were in 1870 or 1880. There's a wonderful book called The Trail Drivers of Texas, which I bought from Larry years ago at an extremely exorbitant price. And he remarked, well, there is a cheap reprint out now, but of course you want the first edition. Yeah, right. So this question of what is a cowboy is not one that I can answer. I don't even know how to ask the right questions. I know that there are a lot of people around who believe very deeply that they are cowboys and who do cowboy work. And I know that there are many people in Wyoming who think that it is definitely the cowboy state. We have the bucking bronco on the license plate. That proves it. I don't know. Stay tuned for the saga of the cowboy.
Now, in Brokeback Mountain, I guess those of us who see a film based on a loved piece of literature, we fear and yearn for a happy ending.
Mm.
And from time to time in your stories, there have been magical devices.
Mm-hmm.
Hell halls or wishing,
yes,
tea kettles,
right,
that make it possible for the obdurate truths about life to be superseded,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
by the magic of wishing and literature.
Right.
How do you make the decision who you'll save with literary magic.
Oh, the hellhole was easy. But Jack and Ennis could not be saved. The funny thing was, while I was working on the story, I was near tears myself many, many, many times, which I found a bit frightening. And yeah, I never could cry. And in 8 years, I haven't been able to, but I have been thinking one day I will be able to. I'll get around to it, but I can't right now. The whole question of large love that comes roaring out of nowhere and just slams you to your knees happens, and it happens to these two. If it were just the sex, it wouldn't even be a story. But there couldn't be another ending. For me, the ending was there enormously and largely before I wrote Once Upon a Time. So.
Well, it rips me apart. I had the same gratitude that the film is true to the truth of the story, and yet at the same time, that yearning, you know.
Oh, a fellow came up to me last night and he just said, please, wouldn't you write a story like this with a happy ending? And I said, you'll have to write that one yourself. And indeed, that's what has to happen. Somebody else has to write one with a happy ending. I can't do it.
Well, I thought about two things. In the newer book of Wyoming Stories, Bad Dirt, there's a story called What Kind of Furniture Would Jesus Pick? And there is a gay son, but by this time, the time of the story or these people, that son is called Sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
Now, no one would dream of calling Jack or Anna Sophisticated.
No. No, it would be almost as bad as saying condiments.
Exactly. but it seems possible. And that night, the father, who's been told about the sophistication of his son by his other son, is aware that he hasn't been told, that he's been shut out of a truth about his son, but he's internalized it and accepted that it must be true. He remembers things from the boy's childhood. And in the same book, there is that wonderful story. I think it's a fabulous story. What is it called? Dump Junk.
Oh, thank you. That story was sort of slighted by everyone, but I had fun writing it, and I liked it.
And I like there are two women in it who have been together for a very long time, and although they are dealt an execration, at least one of them, by the woman's brother, they have had a happy life. And in other words, the unhappiness of Brokeback Mountain isn't the author's sense of obligation, internal obligation. It's a matter of truth.
Yes. And that's why I couldn't write it another way. I had maybe five or six different scenes that I had written that I finally used to start the fire, because they didn't go. What's in the story is what had to be in the story, and that's why it took so long. I finally felt like the balance was there. And then after I sent it to my agent, I realized one more sentence had to be added, which is the last sentence, and called her hastily and added it and told her to send it to a certain magazine, not where it was published, by the way. and a very long silence followed, and we didn't hear, and we didn't hear from this magazine, and finally she gave them an ultimatum of time. We still didn't hear. She sent it to the New Yorker, and they took it within hours. That's when Buford was the editor. So I was surprised. I'd never even thought this story would get published. It was just a thing I was going to write, and it was going to be written, and then it was going to be there, but I didn't think of it as being published.
Now tell me, because almost everyone would be angry at me if I didn't ask. But it's completely not a literary question. When you saw these actors, Jake Gyllenhaal and Heath Ledger, were they your characters?
50%. Jake Gyllenhaal made his own Jack Twist, and a very excellent Jack Twist it is, too, a complex, quicksilver, beautiful, hungry, bitterly disappointed again and again character who still manages to express considerable love and electricity. On the other hand, I found Heath Ledger's performance totally frightening because he got right inside my head. He got stuff that I did not know about Ennis, and he got it right, and I was blown away. I really was by that performance. I thought it was indescribably excellent. I don't know how he did it, but he got that character to an impossible depth. He understood him incredibly well. I don't know how.
It amazed me because it seemed as if he was bringing to the surface the things that people used to say were hidden underneath Randolph Scott's stoicism. You know, that kind of long-suffering look that seemed to belie the things he had to do on screen. And here, in Heath Ledger's performance, it's as if somehow or other, even though it's not done with words, all of that kind of enormous anguish, interest, surprise.
Inchoate longing.
Inchoate longing, yeah. Well, you're the writer.
You ain't too bad yourself, kid.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, there it is. And that, I think, you know, that performance is one of the stunning things that there is to see in movies right now, and
for
a long time,
more.
Too.
I couldn't agree more.
If there were nothing else about this film, the aura around him would, you know, be something you'd send people to see.
Yeah.
I've been speaking with Annie Proulx about her story, Brokeback Mountain, which has recently been made into a film by Ang Lee. Thank you, Annie, for joining me.
My great, great pleasure.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books, to the land of ice and snow in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books. Books, 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 books. Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
You've been listening to KCRW's Bookworm. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Good Food, a weekly exploration of culinary trends, tantalizing recipes, and intriguing discoveries in food and drink. Check out the podcast of Good Food at kcrw.com.